This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Hist. Romeo, hist.
What is it, my dear?
This is the bit where you say the line you keep forgetting, my dear.
Oh, well, we've got till the 26th of April to memorise our lines. Phew.
Hi everyone, you're listening to Thoughts and Theories on ORFM, where I'll delve deeper into the meanings and messages of films, books, TV shows, and more. I'm Asha Amma Asri, and let's get into it. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Thoughts and Theories. My name is Asha Amarasri. How is everybody doing? I'm having a pretty good day myself, and I'm so lucky today to be joined by three amazing guests. I'll have someone who we've had on the show before introduce himself first. So, Brent, why don't you go ahead?
Kia ora tata, ko Brent Caldwell Tukungoa, and I'm here today because we're going to talk about the play I'm directing at the Globe Theatre next month.
Yippee! It's been a long time since you've last come on to the show, so I'm glad to have you here with me today. And I see you've invited two lovely guests as well. Who would like to come introduce themselves first?
Kia ora, ko Kate Tokuingawa. I'm here joining Brent and smiling all the way. So, hello.
Good to have you on.
Thank you.
Yeah, kia ora, folks. I'm Chris, and I'm so thrilled to be here.
Yay. No, I'm so excited. It's been a wee bit since I've last talked about theatre on the show. So, it's always good to have an excuse to do that. So, Brent, you say you are directing a new show.
Yeah.
What show is it?
We're going to put on Romeo and Juliet by William Shakespeare.
Classic.
Opening
classic.
At the Globe on the 21st of May and running till the 30th. And it's a special production because this year is the 65th anniversary of the Globe Theatre.
Oh.
Not to call you out, Usher, but have you been to the Globe Theatre?
I have.
Excellent. So you know that there's that historic house, right?
Yes.
And then attached to it is a theatre. And that theatre that was built in 1961. And can you guess what the first play they did there was?
Oh, my God. Is it Romeo and Juliet?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, my God.
And it was done in May of 1961.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah. So we are just thrilled that we, in 2026, have the opportunity to put it on in May at that really special anniversary time. And we're doing a play which is timeless, really.
Yeah, no, seriously, for sure. Dude, no, that's so exciting.
Yeah.
Did you plan that timing or was it
no.
just – it was a coincidence.
I was umming and ahhing about whether I was going to do it because I was sort of a bit burnt out at the end of last year and
right.
The theatre timetable had to be rejigged. So we had a gap and we didn't want the theatre to be dark. And then one of the committee members, Sheena Townsend, said – absolutely no pressure. But did you realise?
Just casually.
And then it was like, wah, wah. Okay, righto. Okay, so we're going to have to. And then it kind of made sense. And then a couple of other things happened that made it even more perfect.
Right.
We found out that two of the cast from that 1961 show are still kicking around Dunedin.
Oh.
One of them is the grandfather of one of the actors we've cast.
Oh,
so
this is almost too perfect.
Yeah, it is, and that's when I kind of thought, okay, well, you know, we can't not.
The fates have decided.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
it's out of your hands, really.
It is very much out of our hands, but it just seems so right that there's that connection across the generations. So we have an actress in our cast called Megan Stedford Ashford, and you might have known her from some. She was in Taming of the Shrew and Lords and Ladies.
Yes.
So her grandfather, Richard, was about 18 or 19, and he played just one of the people at the start. And there was another chap called Dougal Stevenson, and he is world famous in New Zealand as the face of national news in the 1970s.
Oh my God,
he was
really?
On TV in people's living rooms every night when there was only one channel.
Mm.
And when I was a kid, his voice meant the news.
Right. No pressure, guys.
So both of those guys have agreed to do a unique little cameo in the show.
That's so good. Yeah. That's so good. I'm so looking forward to the show.
100%. So already it's feeling like it's kind of different and special, but it's resting on a really, really great play.
That's amazing. Mm. Like, because it's got a good sense of, like, obviously putting it on today, but also that link historically, having that that link with the cast as well.
Yeah.
Having that line on the 65th anniversary. Yeah. That's too good. That's too good. And what are you guys involved in with the show? Are you guys actors? Are you guys behind the scenes? What's up?
Romeo.
Oh, you're Romeo? Oh, my God. The Romeo. Amazing.
Yeah.
Yep,
yeah.
The Romeo.
And I'm Juliet.
So I've got the two main characters with me here today.
Yes, you do.
How has it been going with rehearsals and all that?
I was saying to one of my friends, at first started off pretty stressful. Because it's a crazy role to take on, you know? Mm-hmm, it's got so much history. If people only know one play in the world, it's Romeo and Juliet, most likely.
100%.
And I was telling my friend, it's the one saving grace of the week, you know? It started off really stressful, and now it's like, I can't wait to get back in that room, get back with those folks, hang out with Brent a little bit.
I think you're right. I mean, it was stressful, but that was only because you go to cast people and you find two actors that you really, really want to work with, and then they say, oh, actually, I'm doing a show on The Fringe. And it's like, oh, what? And then, oh, no. And so I think Chris is right. I found it really stressful too, and it was really bitsy.
Right.
But I'm really glad that we took that into account and we said, okay, because like I said, that slot came up unexpectedly. And when I directed Twelfth Night back in 2024, I had the whole year to think about it.
Right.
And I was doing the dramaturgy paper and I was learning all about the play through the whole year. So it just was like in the crock pot and was bubbling away, where this is a lot more compressed. And, it was a wee bit stressful, but, it's nice to hear that Romeo is a bit more relaxed now.
No, it did take a wee while to warm up to that idea because and also, Brent, you're the kind of person that I'll say, how high when you say jump.
Yeah, yeah. We've got history.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because when he was what was it, your final year of your
first year of honors?
He cast me in this crazy bonkers play called the Universal Light Company's performance of the.
You'll get there.
The Shah and the men of Ish. I can't remember.
I just remember it as Red Mole.
It was a real bonkers title. And then we were cast in a lunchtime theatre called Out at Sea. And we worked together on that. And then that went to Fringe.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, because you've just come out of Fringe, so you know what that's like. And then we took that and performed it in Central Otago. And then we were in a couple of SBZ productions. And, yeah, so when it came to casting, I was prepared to suck up the fact that my acting choices had other priorities, which is not the same for Juliet, happily, because you weren't in Fringe, were you, Kate?
No, I wasn't. No, no.
But what were you in recently?
Well, I was just coming out of The Fox, which was the most recent production at the Globe.
And how did that go?
It was excellent. It was very difficult. Amazing. It was a very, very wordy, it was a drama, and so it was very serious.
Right.
And so I think emotionally the three of us who were performing in that came out of it quite tired because we really given our all to that production and seeing Keith, who's the director and the writer, his vision to the stage. And so when Brent invited me to audition, the fact that I'd never done Shakespeare before was quite intimidating. And he knew this at the time. When he first talked about the audition process, he said, "Now I know that you have said you don't want to do Shakespeare, and I know that you, but just give it a chance."
Right.
And I'm really, really glad I did because I have gone from never performing Shakespeare and not really being exposed to it, to completely immersing myself in the script and being absolutely in love with it.
Right. I'm glad.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think, once you immerse yourself in the poetry of it, and you actually allow yourself to be lulled by the words and you stop being afraid of it and actually engage with it, I think it becomes less of an exercise and, less of a teaching exercise and more of an experience.
No, that's the thing. Yeah. I 100% agree with you. Like, approaching Shakespeare as a performer is the most terrifying thing ever. But, approaching Shakespeare as an appreciator, a viewer, it's just like, wow, the imagery here is amazing.
Yes, really beautiful. You know? Yeah. And I definitely found that, I think, our first read through, Brent invited everyone, if you've done Shakespeare before, please put up your hand. And it was myself and one other person who didn't put up our hands. Everyone else had been involved in something. And so that was quite intimidating, obviously.
Right.
Having this incredible opportunity to be Juliet was quite intimidating because there is that part of you that thinks, oh, gosh, do I deserve to be here? Can I, can I actually live up to this, not having the experience that everyone else is bringing to the room?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm really hoping that I can, prove Brent right.
Right.
Yeah, with his choices.
No, I'm excited to see you guys' interpretation.
Yeah.
Speaking of interpretation, with Romeo and Juliet, it's, as you mentioned, Chris, it's probably the most popular of Shakespeare's plays that even people who don't do theatre would know.
Mm.
And because of that, it's been performed many, many times. So I was wondering, what is it about your guys' rendition of rendition of Romeo and Juliet that would be, a bit different?
Well, coming back to that whole idea of the 65th anniversary, I'd been toying with the idea of setting it in an old folks' home and having aging actors and just flipping it so that Romeo and Juliet are two old people who fall in love in a retirement home and it's their younger family who are against it. Yeah. But it threw up a whole lot of practical barriers, particularly given the time that we've got.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was umming and ahhing about that. And that was probably my biggest reservation because I spoke to a few people last year. I touched base with Lara McGregor and I spoke to Kim Morgan and a few others and Alison Horsley and just chatted to them about what my ideas were, and they gave some really, really frank and honest opinions, and I was just sort of in the process of sort of thinking, okay, well, will I or won't I? And then I remember when I was doing Twelfth Night, Kim Morgan said to me, she said, you can't go wrong with Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
Because the language is the language. It doesn't matter what you do to it, it's still a fantastic play. And so with Sheena sort of saying, well, it's the 65th anniversary, yada yada yada, I kind of thought, well, why don't we give a wee nod to that time period and set it in 1961?
Okay.
And let's bring it back to Otago and let's, instead of having, sort of noble families warring, let's have two farming families feuding. Because my background, my parents were farmers and, small communities, there's always a wee bit of argy-bargy. And you look at what happens in Romeo and Juliet, that's happening every day.
Mm-hmm.
Every day that you talk to people, they've fallen out with their family or they've chosen a partner their family doesn't like and there's dramas and all those sorts of things. So I thought, let's see if we can do it. So I just went through that wee exercise and thought, well, oh, this could be that and that could be this and, oh, yeah, it could work.
Mm-hmm.
And same with Twelfth Night. Everything just sort of dominoes and you go, yeah. And that's the beauty of those Shakespearean plays. They are relocatable. And I know some people sort of think, well, that's not sort of like 100% Shakespeare, but to me, it's the language, and we're not dickering with the language at all. We're speaking the script as it is.
Mm-hmm.
We've cut it down for modern audiences, so we've trimmed it by 1,000 lines, which sounds like a lot, but it's still going to be the 2 hours traffic of our stage, as they say in the prologue. And all the parts have basically reduced slightly. So there's still a fair, like Chris and Kate were joking at the start there, about you've got to have books down. There's a fair bit to get your head around. So 1961, and if you are thinking of whereabouts in Otago, we're not saying it's – we're saying Verona is in Otago.
Right.
So think Outram blended with Waitahuna and with a wee bit of Lawrence dashed in, and it's that kind of vibe.
No, that's really nice because it makes it uniquely New Zealand, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like it makes our own twist to it. And bringing it with the 65th anniversary is kind of like so genius. Like whose idea did you say it was in the beginning?
Our treasurer, Sheena Townsend, was saying, did you realise that this year is the 65th anniversary? Right. And we did, because when we were fundraising for the operational grants with the Community Trust, we called this year our 65th anniversary season. So we knew that, but it was kind of like, well, let's line the ducks up. Mm-hmm. It's May, it's Romeo and Juliet, let's make it 1961. And, you know, when you think we've got those two blokes who were in the 1961 show, it makes us think, well, what was their life like then? Mm-hmm. You know, what was the music they listened to? What were the clothes that they wore? What were the attitudes? And that's exactly what we're trying to capture.
Right.
So our soundtrack is all number ones or top five songs off the New Zealand Hit Parade of 1960 and 61.
Oh, my God, that's exciting.
Yeah.
I bet if anyone older in the audience would be listening to that and they'd be like, oh, like, you know, a flash of the past sort of thing.
Yeah. And see, the thing is 1961 Otago, you say 1960s and people instantly think Mini Coopers with the Union Jack on, people mm-hmm. in mini skirts, Carnaby Street. Mm-hmm. But we're going 1961 New Zealand was probably more like 1953 everywhere else. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this is Otago, probably the most conservative, well, maybe after Southland, the most conservative province.
Yeah.
And I can say that because I'm from Morihiku, so it's all right.
Yeah, okay.
So, and of course, the fashions, you know, farming fashions in 1961, they would have been the same as they've been wearing, you know, since 1940.
Right.
Knitted jumpers, woolen pants, you know, white shirts, you know, singlets. So from a staging point of view, we're trying to keep as true to the period as we can.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
That's excellent. I have a question for both Kate and Chris. Have you guys worked together before?
Yeah.
As love interests?
No.
Okay, so this is the first time. How has it been sort of like tackling that together, and how do you like get rid of any awkwardness if there was any?
Well, I think for me what's been really special and kind of linking back to, you know, Brent and Chris having worked together years ago is back when I was a first-year student, Chris was, you know, doing his honours. And I went and watched Brent and perform and, you know, Chris was, oh, my gosh, he's one of the postgrad students and he's doing all these incredible things. And, oh, my gosh.
He had the aura.
Yeah,
he gave us our start.
Yeah, he did. He had that aura. And then over the years, you know, as I got more involved, I was able to work, you know, with him, you know, then I was doing the stage, well, no, it wasn't stage managing, I was doing the tech for Out at Sea. And so I've kind of been on the fringes of things he's been involved in. And then gradually I was in another play, The Real Inspector Hound, with him in 2022. And last year.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that.
I was wondering if that was going to be brought up.
I forgot that.
Elephant in the room, Real Inspector Hound.
What's the elephant?
Well, you didn't bring it up.
Oh, sorry.
I was waiting for you to say. So, yeah, all three of us were actually involved in a play that I directed and I cast the both of them. And
here we are
years later, reunited.
Wow, Brent.
All I can say to you, Romeo, is that old age is not for sissies.
isn't this coming from the same lad who once upon a time said something along the lines of, the 60s of your life are bitching? And that's a quote that I'm going to take away forever.
Well, I would say that whatever decade I'm in. But yes, I forgot that. So, Kate, you were in Real Inspector Hound with Chris?
Yeah, that was.
Yeah?
Yes. You know, and gradually as time has gone on, we've been working closer and closer together, and now I feel like it's kind of the eclipse of both our, you know, our acting trajectories.
I love the way you phrase that. That's
thank
perfect.
You. Thank you. Yeah. And yeah, it is, you know, I think it's lovely. It's because I've worked with him so much. I've seen the way he's worked and I've observed the way he's worked. And so he's someone who I feel completely safe with, and I really admire the way he works. And it's just very special for me to be able to actually now be alongside him as a peer, as opposed to, you know, a first year going, oh, he's so cool, he's a postgrad.
Yeah. So the relationship you guys have built up since then clearly has helped you guys with this process
definitely.
So far.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the steps that we've taken as a production around the intimacy?
Yeah. We've got a fantastic intimacy coordinator, Chelsea, who recently did Casket Case for Fringe. And has been, of course, sort of de facto for a few other shows for the Globe. Was she there for The Fox?
No.
No, not there for The Fox. But she was there for another show that I worked on, Crunchy Silk, which was also at the Globe last year. So she's taken these steps and comes into rehearsal and essentially has got it all already figured out. You know, you're going to turn your head this way. You're going to move in 90% and then they're going to move in the last 10%. You're going to hold a kiss for a beat and then you're going to break up and then, you know, you're going to say your line. And it really, really helps sort of ease that as you know, you say awkwardness, because it can sort of get awkward. You think, oh, I'm out at sea, you know. I'm here floating alone, right. And then suddenly, you know, you've got these folks around you who are absolutely open, you know, who are like, yeah, sure, let's give this a go, or they know their boundaries, you know, they're like, okay, I'm not going to do a lip kiss, instead I'm going to put a thumb, and I'm going to kiss my thumb instead of your lips, because, you know, you may not be feeling it that day. And so it's nice to have that from Kate, and have that support from Chelsea, which makes the whole experience a lot funner, because it's same for fight choreography.
Right,
it's like, you know, if you're going into a fight and you've got no clue what the moves are,
you don't actually want to knock somebody out.
So we've got a fantastic fight choreographer as well. So having both those supports helping with the more sort of active action-y side of the play is just so fantastic. So thank you for bringing those folks in, Brent.
Well, you talk about Chelsea McRae, because she did her master's thesis on the whole aspect of intimacy in the industry. And I know she's doing further study this year to develop that so that she may actually be able to do that professionally and offer those services. So in a way, the Globe, I mean, I've always had this idea that theatres should be places where you can teach and learn. So Chelsea's got the chance to stretch her legs and expand her practice. We've got the chance to benefit from that, because I know that, you know, she's got a real passion for that, and she's doing further study in that. And so we give her that opportunity. And for us, one of the challenges of doing Romeo and Juliet, a lot of people call it, you know, one of Shakespeare's problem plays. And why? And why? Because in his original play, Juliet's only 13.
Right.
And people instantly raise their eyebrows. And again, that's part of our adaptation. The other thing is, as actors, a lot of times, you know, it's one of those things, once you know, you wouldn't think of not doing it. It's like health and safety. And it is a health and safety thing. So previously, a director might have said, okay, well, you two, this is the scene where you kiss. Just get on with it. That'll be fine. And you've got no idea what the actors are bringing with them. And so what I've really enjoyed is the bravery of our actors to basically go follow Chelsea's lead. So Chelsea gave a talk to all of the cast initially just to set the co-pupper. And then she will work with people who have intimacy scenes in the play, like Kate has another actor that she has an intimate moment with, and that's been worked through. There's obviously their scenes, and it's not just, you know, kissing and things like that. There's there's the emotional level of it and how actors arrive and how they feel. And Chelsea just gives us a language to use.
Right.
And as a director, it's just such a relief to think, oh, I don't have to I don't have to worry about that, because you know, that's not my forte. I'm no intimacy coordinator. And it's just lovely to have a professional person come in, and you see your cast just relax and go, yeah. And then there's laughter and there's fun. And in fact, that's probably my biggest problem as a director at the moment, having people giggle. But it does tell you something, doesn't it? It tells you that your actors are on the same wavelength, the safety. And when there's safety, the Shakespeare-ness of it all won't get lost by the audience thinking, oh, that must be tricky.
Right.
Because everyone's going to look so comfortable. And I like Chris's point about the fight choreography, because it's just exactly the same.
Because I'd imagine what it is that makes people so like worried about it is that uncertainty, right? And when you hesitate and, you know, all that stuff, there's so many things that you could do
wrong. So having that clarity of like you said, Chris, that the like 90 degrees forward, 90 degrees, you know, what I mean, 90%, yeah. whatever, that step-by-step process, like it's people just want to be led in like these uncertain times and knowing what people's boundaries are. Of course, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what sort of what I imagined.
Absolutely. Yeah, because I think, I know for me, like being in the moment, you suddenly think, do I actually know how to kiss? Like, do I actually know how to caress someone's cheek? Am I overthinking this? Will this look correct? And is all these things you're thinking about and actually, you know, leaving it up to the actor is, you know, kind of a recipe for disaster because, you know, they're in the moment. They're in, you know, it can be quite stressful putting that pressure onto them. Mm-hmm. So when you have someone in who's gone away and done the research and be like, right, I'm going to watch Bridgerton, I'm going to watch this. What looks good? How can I stage this in a way that this looks really amazing for the audience? And I'm going to take this back, I'm going to put this into choreography, and I'm going to teach the actors to do exactly this so that it looks really good.
Right.
And they don't have to worry about it. You know, it's just a step-by-step recipe to get something really beautiful.
That's amazing.
Ooh. Yeah.
Watching Bridgerton is so real, though.
Yeah.
It's a good reference.
Yeah.
But do you find, though, that you copy what other people do or you do what you think Juliet would do?
I think when it comes to the intimacy and kind of those more intimate moments, particularly at the moment because they're so brief, I feel like the love story isn't told through those intimate moments. Mm. It's told through the yearning. It's told through the moments around it. So, you know, in those moments is not necessarily what would Juliet do? It's she's 16. Yes, of course she's going to kiss this man because, you know, she's only got a couple of hours to do this.
Mm. Right.
You know, I think it's nice actually just having some kind of more cookie-cutter moments like that to express those moments so that we as actors can focus on, honestly, the really juicy bits, which is the yearning and, the storytelling around it.
Real. So, no, 100%.
Yeah.
On that thought, we're going to take a wee break. I'm sure our actors and director would like a wee break with from all this amazing talking. The song that we've chosen today is Last Date by Floyd Kramer. I wanted to ask real quick, Brent, why did you choose this song?
We chose that song because it's kind of like the opening theme of the show. And it's like, when I heard it, I thought, God, this sounds like some country and western thing. But I looked it up, you know, number one, March of 1961. And I'm thinking, oh, okay.
Oh, my God, amazing.
And your listeners will hear it when you play it. It's real country and it's really sort of, you know, just strolling.
Okay, amazing. Yeah. So if you guys want to get more of a vibe of what we're talking about, listen to this.
Thank you.
welcome back, guys. I hope you guys enjoyed that song, and I hope you guys have more of a vibe on what Romeo and Juliet is like. Mm-hmm. And speaking of Romeo and Juliet, I feel like it would be a waste of an opportunity not to, like, sort of dive deeper into these characters, specifically since I've got the actors for those two characters right here. So when you guys walked in to, you know, undertaking this role, did you guys have any, like, certain expectations going into it, any surprises or things like that, any inspirations for how you interpreted the character? I don't know. What's the vibe?
I grew up, you know, having already watched the Baz Luhrmann, Romeo and Juliet, and of course, the lovely, the 67 version. Mm-hmm. And so going into this, I knew that I wanted to sort of have my own version, because when people think about, you know, Romeo, they may instantly have Leonardo DiCaprio's face in mind, the right. way that he performed. And, you know, you don't want to copy and paste those performances because, mm-hmm. you know, being there in high school, you watch these plays, you watch these versions, and that's the kind that sticks.
Yeah.
So there's some lines that I'll deliver and I'll be like, ooh, I know why I'm delivering it that way, because that's how Leonardo DiCaprio delivered it that way, or that's how Kenneth Branagh, you know, delivered it in the BBC radio play. So going into it, I'm definitely trying to make Romeo fully my own,
right?
Especially since, you know, Kate is coming in with her own unique version of Juliet, and I feel like it'd be a disservice to, you know, myself, her, the show, if I was just copy and pasting,
yeah.
you know, Romeo from the 1990s movie. And so I think that that's something that I've been very conscious about, is allowing Romeo to fully be my version as opposed to someone else's.
Right. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I think when I was younger, I had a Lady Bird book of Romeo and Juliet, which was my only kind of exposure to what the character was like. But Brent lent me this really, really beautiful book called Looking for Juliet, which was essentially a PhD dissertation on the character of Juliet, how she's been played throughout time. And that was really useful for me for contextualizing who Juliet actually is, because I think on a superficial level, you know, she can kind of just seem kind of like a shrinking violet.
Right.
You know, the girl falls in love with the boy and then she's so sad. And she, you know, things happen.
No spoilers. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we won't tell you how it ends.
Yeah. Actually, guys, fun fact. You know, Chris, it's funny that you bring up, like, you know, whatever you see, like, in your youth that sort of, like, sticks in your head. Mm. I've never actually seen the full story of Romeo and Juliet. I've never seen the movie. I've never read the play. I know how it ends.
Okay.
And I know, like, you know, the highlights of it and the controversy and stuff like that. So I'm really excited to go into the show and fully take in, you know, your guys' interpretation from beginning to end without having any, like, background knowledge, because I genuinely don't know what goes on.
Yeah. And I think that's a really common experience. You know, I think, you know, for, you know, people coming out of schools and stuff, you've got ugly Shakespeare. You know, I think for many audience members, they've, you know, gathered bits and pieces of these stories, and that was definitely for me. You know, the Lady Bird book definitely wasn't complete. Like, yeah, I think I missed out a few bits here and there.
Just a bit.
Yeah, just a few.
I can't imagine what those parts would be.
Yeah. Well, discovering them now, you have to come to the show and watch.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and this was a really moment, you know, as Chris said, to piece together what we've seen before with who we are as individuals. Because I think for myself, I'm not 16, so, you know, I can't, you know, I can do my best interpretation of what it is like to be 16, but ultimately I am the age that I am, which is 23, but who I am as a person is I am very bubbly, and I'm very much I'm very much a smell the roses kind of person, and so that's what I really bring to the character, is that kind of, that zest for life. You know, that absolute desire to love and love quickly and love deeply, to her detriment, unfortunately. But that's kind of my end route with the character, is that desire to absolutely throw yourself head first into this moment of autonomy, which for Juliet is, there's this boy, I want him. Mum's got other choices, but this is what I want.
And so for me, that's actually really beautiful.
Yeah, no, genuinely, yeah. That is lovely. And there's something about, you know, being a teenager, you feel so many things, right? And you have nowhere to put them because your body is still growing. And it's like these emotions are all, they're all like snappy, quick, like 1 minute you're really angry and then you're in love or something like that. And I really like the term head over heels because I feel like that really does encapsulate, I think, most like first loves, first romances.
Absolutely.
And I guess it's just got me wondering, like, do you guys remember what it was like when you guys had your first love story, like when you were teenagers? Like, do you remember the feeling, if not the person, like, and why you felt that way?
It was possible to fall in love at 16.
Tell you what, at 16, I for sure thought it was possible for me to fall in love.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, at 16, it was ride or die, you know.
100%.
Yeah, you know, it'd be, you know, one of your friends. I'm like, yeah, I'm getting married to this person.
100%.
You know? I'm 16. My brain is absolutely fully developed. I'm going to, you know, follow this person to the ends of time. And suddenly there's someone else. Oh.
It's like, I'm going to get married to this person tomorrow. And then 3 hours later, like, I actually don't care about this man anymore.
That's pretty much the character of Romeo encapsulated because he does start off the play in love with someone else.
Yes.
And then suddenly he sees Juliet and he's like head over heels, you know, completely turns. I think he says, did my heart love till now? You know, did he even know what love was until he, you know, had a look at Juliet? And I think that's sort of...
But he's got a credibility problem with everyone around him.
he does.
Because he says, no, really.
Yeah.
I'm really in love.
For real this time, guys, for sure.
And everyone's going, oh, yeah, of course you are.
Here we go. So what does this mean about Romeo? Is he more like an F-boy sort of like character? is that what it is?
No, I think he's an old-timey yearner, you know. Romeo probably would have been one of the original yearners, you know. He spends so much of the time at the beginning of the play before he meets Juliet, you know, pontificating about how much he loves someone else. And there's a line that the friar says is like, these words sound like they're rote. You know, he's heard Romeo say these things so many times again and you know, listening to folks that's talking about their experiences at 16 and sort of jogging some memories. I'm like, oh, yeah, maybe there was, you know, one or two folks where I was like, absolutely, absolutely, I would have married them.
Right.
And then, you know, someone new comes along and it's like, yeah, I would have married them too.
No, that's so real. Actually, Brent, do you remember what it was like when you were 16?
I probably wasn't in love. I was probably in crush, you know.
Right.
You fixate on someone and you fantasize about, yeah, it'll be great. And, you know, and, you know, you've built a whole world, but you can't even talk to them. You sort of say, and they say, oh, this is my friend.
Suddenly tripping over your own tongue.
Oh, man.
No, I get it.
And that kind of, and I think in this play, it's that excruciating force that really pushes these two together. And in our setting, because if you think of, you know, the original setting, it was sort of the children of two nobles. Mm-hmm. So they're both reasonably high-born and, you know, they've got a lot of status and things. But in our play, Juliet is just on the cusp of becoming a debutante. So she's just sort of 18-ish. We're thinking that she's 18. And it's funny for me, and I've been telling Kate, because I've got four older sisters, and all of them were debutantes.
This is the
first one I can remember is my sister Elizabeth. She was about 1968. I was five and I couldn't understand what all the hoo-ha was about, but she had this white dress and my dad had a tuxedo on, and then there was Robin's dead ball. And by the time Jane and Nicholas came around, I thought, hey, I'll just go and sit down and watch TV. This is not about the boys. And so, you know, and we were from a Catholic community, and so they'd have the Catholic debutante ball every year. The kids would get presented to the bishop. So that was playing in my head when I was thinking, what would be the thing that would bring Juliet out into the open in this farming community? Mm-hmm. So, and we're just settling it around a pub. Which is owned by the Capulet family. Tybalt's the manager, but there's kind of like a presentation or a pre-drinks thing there. And of course, that it's just so what happened in the country back in those days, you know. And if you look in the Gisborne, because when I was researching this, I was looking in these magazines from 1950s and 60s, and they used to announce the debutantes in the newspapers, you know, like they do.
So it was like a big thing.
Yeah, like engagements, you know, hatches, matches and dispatches in the back of the ODT. In these sort of pictorial magazines and, say, from the Bay of Plenty and around there, you know, sort of Bay of Plenty Life or something, there'd be photos of Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so's daughter Jane was presented at the – and she's standing there in this white outfit and it's like, oh, my goodness me. And this is in – this went right through the 60s, and I guess the further south you go, the longer it lasted, whereas in Auckland it was kind of poo-pooed during the mid-60s. But, yeah, my sister Nicola was presented in 1977.
Right.
You know, and it was like, you know, I was I was 14, and yeah, it was still a big gig, and I was showing Kate the photo of the dancing that they did.
Oh wow!
Yeah, my parents thought it was a big event. It was basically saying, okay, my daughter's finished her education; she's now of marriageable age and can be out sociable.
Right, and so this is sort of like what Juliet is sort of like approaching to, and things like that.
Yeah,
hey, no,
yeah, and Romeo and his mates, typical farm boys. They gatecrash the party at the pub. You know, a few free drinks.
Romeo saw Juliet and was like, that one.
Yeah,
that one right there. That one in the dress.
For real this time, guys. For real.
Yeah. Guys, believe me. It's for the drinks. Yeah. Oh, no, that's fantastic. So in the beginning soundbite, you guys were talking about memorizing lines. How are you guys going with that?
Well, one of us is going really well.
No, I think that I've been going well. It's sort of that sort of cusp zone, you know the story well, you know the beats, you know A to B, and you feel like you could say it, and then you look at the actual Shakespearean words and you're like, oh my gosh, what I just tried saying out loud does not quite match what is on that on that page. So it's sort of an interesting place to be,
right,
knowing that the next step is you'll have those lines, you'll have those specific words, you know, aside from the beats, the moments, the emotions.
I got to say, from a directing point of view, these guys are doing such a great job.
Oh, that's great.
Because what we've said is even if you're not on the stage rehearsing a scene, come to the rehearsal and be there at the back and use that time. You know that that's the rehearsal time because, you know, these guys are busy people. They're professional people during the day and they've got their jobs to do. Then they come and they have to add all this stuff into it. And, yeah, all the cast are making a heck of a job at it. And I think they all feed off each other. When they see what the others are doing, that creates that kind of expectation. Okay, I don't want to let the team down.
Yeah. And Bridge is a good environment as well while you're there.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, there's a real good – and I have to say, I mean, we cast the actors we wanted to cast based on the vision that we had, but – everyone who was chosen was they were also chosen because they've got a demonstrated track record of doing the work. I don't think across any of our cast we've got anyone who's kind of phoning it in and just sort of turning up. I'll just do it, and I'll. That's not how it's being done.
Okay, that's good.
People are really, really a cohesive approach to. Yeah, we're going to put on something really special, and I just walked away from our last two rehearsals thinking, this is.
You guys are going to be ready.
Well, we're going to be ready, but it's going to be good.
That's great.
Yeah.
And it sounds like, you know, the cast, of course, is doing like a lot of hard work, but I'm aware that in a production, it's a lot of like all hands on deck sort of thing. So it's not just the cast and the director doing the work. So I was sort of wondering, like, how has it been like with the other creatives on board? Like, because I think I'm aware, is it Maggie who is doing your costumes?
Yep.
Right? How is she doing? And how
she's
is everyone
doing
else
great. Doing? But at the heart of all of it, because I used to think that the director was the main person in any production. Until I directed 12th Night and realized that it's your production manager.
Right.
They're the person who carry the show. They answer all the questions and they create the space for the director to create and the actors to act. And you know our production manager as one of your directors, Penelope Hare.
Right, yes.
And so I was her production manager for Alice. Mm-hmm. She's very kindly reciprocated. So we've got her producing. And as a result of that, everything flows. So we've got Cody McRae doing the lighting design. We've got Steve Parker, who was in Lords and Ladies. He's doing the sound design.
Oh, fantastic.
We've got Amber Munro, who was in Lords and Alice as the puppeteer.
Right.
And she's a girl I've known since she was five. I started her at Mornington Primary School, watched her come right through Logan Park. She's an amazing artist. And I just said, would you like to design our backdrops?
Yeah.
So she's doing that. What else have we got? Nick Turner is our stage manager, but he's also a member of the cast.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Like a busy guy, though.
Yep. Chelsea McRae's doing our socials, and the amazing Don Townsend is doing all our photos and things. Who have I forgotten?
Andrew and Ash.
Yeah, Andrew Brinsley-Paree and Ashley Stewart are our fight choreographers, because I remember saying to Chris, we need fight choreographers. Mm-hmm. He said, I know this guy. And so we
just casually,
yeah. And wow, those guys are amazing. Mm-hmm. And
that's great.
And again, and of course, we've got Chelsea also as the intimacy coordinator. And it's just lovely as a director to be thinking, all right, I'm working on the scene. Mm. And Penelope's out the back going, whoosh, making sure everyone falls in line and everyone's on target. And you're right, Maggie's doing our costumes and doing a fab job. And we're just at funneling towards our date of the 1st of May, which is where we want everyone to.
That's D-Day, I believe.
Well, yeah, it's D-Day for a lot of the artistic stuff and the creative stuff. It's also just after the D-Day for the cast to have their lines down. Mm-hmm. And while that seems a long way ahead of the production, what we know is that a cast that have got their scripts down are able to focus on the language and their acting.
Right. Okay.
Right, team?
Yes, sir. You guys can't see this. They're quaking their boots right now.
Yeah.
Tied to their chairs. Yeah. Brent's one scary guy, guys.
Hey. Teacher face.
All right, so we're almost running out of time. So I sort of wanted to ask you guys one last question before we head off. I wanted to bring back again to what Chris was saying before, like, because this has sort of stuck with me, like, how Romeo and Juliet is so, like, enduring, right? Like, it's been done a lot of times and everyone knows about it. And, of course, it's about, like, it's a tragic love story, right? So I wanted to ask you guys all, what is it about romance that is so interesting for people to hear, watch, that, you know, makes it so, undying, even, like, the multiple ways that it has been performed in different shows and different forms, like love songs, love stories, TV shows, and things like that. So what is it about love that is so interesting for people to hear about?
I think it's sort of one of those conceits that everyone just knows exists. And I think that's what's really special about Romeo and Juliet, is it does have a lot of juxtaposition. Mm-hmm. It is about love, but it's also about hate. And these are things that people will fundamentally understand. You know, looking at Shakespeare Festival at high school, you know, you'll always see a lot of scenes mm-hmm. where students are performing Romeo and Juliet, because they will understand, you know, the heart of the story. And even if the love isn't specifically about romantic love, there's still so much more. Familial love. Shout out to my cat. You know, massively love my cat, who's been watching me, you know, go through my lines all the time. But this is definitely something that stands out about the play, is that it is universal in its themes.
Yeah. And I think as well, you know, for anyone, I think there are potentially very few people who have not had their hearts broken. I think it's very soothing to be able to see it happen on stage and be able to feel that together with everyone else in the audience and be like, oh, I know what that feels like. You know, mm-hmm. I feel seen. You 100%. Know, I know what this feels like. I know this pain. Oh, you know, just that being able to share in that human experience. I think what's so special about theatre is you're able to do that with everyone else around you. And, you know, if you're crying and the person next to you is crying, you're like, oh, I'm feeling this together with everyone else.
I'm not alone.
So, yeah,
100%.
What she said.
word for word.
No, I think, you know, why has the play lasted so long? Why have these plays stood the test of time? Because they're all about, you know, the human condition. You know, as human beings, we experience emotions, and love is one of the greatest, but it's a double-edged sword. When it goes well, it's fantastic. When it goes not so well, it cuts to the crack, and therefore everybody, and like Kate just said, you know, you can be watching a character in that play, because in the play, some people don't get to love. Mm-hmm. Some people lose their lives, and we've all been touched by these things in our lives, and when we watch it, we identify, but at a visceral level, you know, our whole system responds. Mm. So yeah,
that's fantastic, and I think you guys all had worded it so wonderfully. Thank you guys so much for coming onto the show. I really appreciate you guys taking the time to come and share, you know, your wonderful experiences with the show. Remind me again, when are the show dates? Where can people buy the tickets?
The show opens on the 21st of May and runs to the 30th of May. There's a matinee on that middle weekend. Tickets are available from Humanitex, but the easiest way to get there is to go to the Globe's website, look mm-hmm. under Current Productions, and just click on the link and it'll take you there. There's concession prices for students and for older people. And we've got a few school groups interested in coming along. Mm. I would just say, and to coin a phrase, get in. before the tickets run out the door, because we only have 72 seats in the auditorium.
Yeah, they're going to run fast.
And we've got a big cast, and we know that people are going to want to come and see this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, amazing. Before we head off, did anyone want to do some last-minute shout-outs or anything that they wanted to say?
Well, speaking of high schoolers who are coming, I'd love to shout-out to my high school drama teacher, Nick Meisel from Dunstan High School, who's bringing his drama students to come watch.
Oh, amazing.
So that's very special for me, because Nick and I go back to, go way back. So
I love you. Thank you for coming. Fantastic.
Yeah, on the topic of love, my parents celebrated their 30th wedding anniversary.
It
sort of puts the whole thing into a little bit of perspective, especially given that these are the folks who've enabled me. You know, once upon a time, my father was my English teacher.
Oh, my days.
So having that in the background there is definitely fueling and motivating and increasing us as we go into production period. Mm.
And to quote Bruce Almighty, behind every man there's a woman rolling her eyes. I would just like to shout out to my wife Shona and also to her boss Kerry from Sumpter Moore Lawyers in Milton, who've provided us with some wonderful country style props in the form of deer antlers and things, just to give us that whole farming vibe.
Right. Okay. Amazing. Again, thank you guys so much for coming by. Guys, thank you for listening. I know it's a really tough time in the world right now with the fuel crisis and everything like that. Don't lose hope. I think that's something that we really need to hold on to. So listen to take a page out of Kate's book. Be a little bit more positive and cheery with life. You know, appreciate the small things. And one of the things you can do is, you know, appreciate local theater maybe. Talk to your loved ones. Don't let yourself doom scroll on Instagram too much. That will just make you too sad. Don't forget to boycott Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and Starbucks, and have a wonderful day. Thank you guys so much. Thank you all for joining me today on Thoughts and Theories. I hope you've learned something new or taken away something to think about. I hope to see you all next time. Till then, this has been Thoughts and Theories with Asha Amma Asri.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.